tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's the buzz? Tell me what's happening, what's
welcome
the
to Friday. Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. It's time to recap the major events of the week in the Seattle area. I'm Bill Radke. This week, the Washington State Supreme Court fined the state of Washington, in other words, fined the taxpayers, $100,000 a day for every day we fail to fund public education. The first time that's ever happened in Washington that I know of. The court has for years been telling the legislature it is violating the state constitution by not having a plan to adequately pay for schools. We have been waiting to see how the court will back up its threats. Now we know something about that. So what happens next? Joining us live is the Olympia correspondent for Associated Press, Rachel LaCourt. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Based on the reporting you've been doing the last 24 hours or so, how will the governor and the legislature react to the court's move?
Well, the governor's already set a meeting for Monday up in Seattle, and it'll be him and legislative leaders, and they're basically going to talk this through. It's not likely they're going to come out of that meeting with a decision on what's next, because I'm sure there are probably varying opinions at this point. But they essentially have two options: call a special session and return to Olympia, which is what the court strongly suggested in its order yesterday, or just put this $100,000 a day aside into this education account until the next regularly scheduled legislative session begins on January 11th. And you only have to look at this year's legislative session to see that a special session on an issue of this magnitude would not be a quick and painless thing. Remember, the legislature just left town last month. So there's been 1 month of kind of like relative quiet here in Olympia. And that was because they struggled to agree on a budget plan that even included a down payment on education funding. So if they had that much trouble earlier in the year, I'm sure that's in the minds of the governor and lawmakers. They might just choose to ignore the court for a while, because in the context of a $38 billion state operating budget, a fine of $100,000 a day is really small in that scope.
Okay, well, we're going to talk more in a moment about the impact of a $100,000 a day fine. But first, will you remind us what the court wants the state to do to fund education that it hasn't done?
Sure. This started in a 2012 ruling, where it basically said that the state funding for education is not adequate under the state constitution. And the constitution basically says the state has one job, one paramount duty, and that's to amply provide for the education of children of the state. So since that 2012 ruling, the courts repeatedly said they're not going to tell the legislature how to get there, but that the legislature needs to provide a sufficient plan. They gave them until 2018 to fix the problem, but demanded yearly progress reports showing that they were making progress. Basically, yesterday's order, the court said, hey, you guys haven't made adequate progress. We see what you've done. Thank you very much for that. But you still haven't done what we've asked you to do, which is to give us a full plan. And so the court stressed they don't have the authority to enact legislation, appropriate funds, impose taxes, but they can still demand that the state present a full plan. So they're not saying you have to come back, you know, and pass all of these new taxes and do all of this stuff. They just say you need to come back and show us a plan, not only of the progress that you've made, but very specific ways that you're going to get there, because 2018 is just around the corner.
And we're talking about reducing class sizes, increasing pay for teachers and administrators, more education funding coming from the state and less from local school district levies. How much money would all this cost?
Well, and there's an ongoing debate on that total cost, but the amount cited has been anywhere from between $2 to $4 billion a year. And the problem with the plan and the reason they keep getting stuck is that that's a lot of money. And when there's a price tag that high on something, there's always going to be a battle over how to pay for it, which means there's no easy solution to this.
Okay. And as you said, when you're talking about $3 billion a year or so, $100,000 a day doesn't seem like so much. So how does the court's decision yesterday to fine the state, how does that change the dynamic here?
Well, it certainly puts the topic of education funding back in the news cycle in a very, very strong way, and right before the school year starts. So when the Supreme Court unanimously tells the state they need to step it up and starts this daily sanction, it it gets attention. And so I think just that very public attention is sort of maybe changing the dynamic of the conversation.
Okay, here's what I don't understand, Rachel, talking with Rachel Accord from Associated Press in Olympia. If the governor doesn't call the special session right away, they just wait until the next regular legislative session, they'll have racked up about $15 million in fines, all to be eventually applied toward the education budget. And as you just said, the court is telling them to spend $3 billion. So I don't see how this lights a fire anyone. The court is saying if you don't spend a lot on education, we're going to force you to spend a little bit. How does this put any more pressure on lawmakers?
And that's a good question. And some lawmakers have already said, what's the point of coming back in a special session? It's easier to just pay the fine. And again, the way to say it is not paying a fine. They're reallocating funds.
Right.
They're putting funds toward an account that's going to go toward education. So if all that money is going to be spent toward education anyway, I think that's probably what's going to come up in this meeting on Monday of lawmakers saying, why should we rush back between now and the end of December to take on this issue when all the money that we're paying as ordered by the court is only going into a special account. I guess the question is whether the court will think that's sufficient. So if the governor doesn't call a special session, will the court weigh in again by the end of the year and step things up? They indicated in their order that this sanction was the least onerous of what they could have done. So they could come back and raise the fine. They could come back and say, we're going to step in a more a stronger way. Nobody really knows at this point.
Monday should be very, very interesting. Olympia correspondent for Associated Press, Rachel LaCourte, joining us live. Thanks for the update.
All right. Thank you.
By the way, KUOW's Capitol correspondent, Austin Jenkins, he's out of the state. So let's analyze what we just heard. Our panel this hour on the Week in Review includes Seattle PI columnist Joel Connolly. Hi, Joel.
Morning.
What else do we need to know now to understand what is happening, unprecedented this is, what is happening in our state government right now?
I think we need to hear from the governor. We need to hear a lot more than the banal partisan boilerplate that I got, that my email box was inundated with yesterday. I would note that the governor is having a big ticket fundraiser at noon today with Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey. In addition to the paying guests at the convention center, I think that this issue is an 800-pound gorilla in the middle of the room. It is interesting that Inslee shuts these things off to media coverage, unlike Chris Gregoire. I think given the fact of this major issue that broke yesterday, they might consider opening the fundraiser to media coverage, or at the very least providing a full transcript of what the governor has to say, since I don't think there's any way he would not mention this.
I can't wait to find out how much pressure this actually seems to put on lawmakers to do anything different. Also on our panel this hour, Seattle journalist Erica C. Barnett, you've written about the education funding fight. What is your take?
I've written a little bit about it. My take, my initial take was actually that I thought the fine seemed like quite a bit. It occurred to me, well, it's not actually on the legislators. Last time, when the legislature was held in contempt, each individual legislator was held responsible. So I guess I was a little surprised that there wasn't more attention paid to or more sanctions put on the legislators directly, because you're right, this doesn't actually provide much of an incentive for them to go back into special session. I don't know what they're going to accomplish if they do move this forward until January, because then you have the regular session, you have all the usual pressures, and it's hard to see it going much differently than the last session, where they sort of put a down payment toward education. But clearly, I mean, this is a 9-0 decision, which was actually the thing that did kind of astonish me. Clearly, the state Supreme Court has said this is inadequate, and you did not do a good job last time. The legislature believed that they did. So I think we're right back where we started in a lot of ways.
The nuclear option would have been for the court to strike down that whole part of the state budget as unconstitutional, and I don't know, potentially shut down the school system. Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo, welcome.
Hello.
You have kids in the public school system. I know this because your essay about parenthood has been on KOW's website all week long. What's your take?
You know, what interests me about this is, I mean, we've been having this discussion for years, and we always talk about the legislature, we always talk about the government, but we don't talk about the fact that the reason why they've been able to hem and haw on this for 3 years now is because the public will to really resolve this isn't there. And the truth is it's how we as parents and community members look at funding education that really allows the government to continue to put this off. There is no political will to address really how we as a state, as people of the state, have decided to fund education.
You mean we have responsibility here?
Yes.
Rats.
I would just add that the toxic solution for Seattle, anyway, is the levy swap. And what that would do is basically take away the responsibility of cities to fund education, which results in this really unequal system of allocation where Seattle has better schools and other wealthier areas have better schools because we have more money. So we fund, you know, those good schools with local levies, places east of the mountains less so. And so the levy swap would equalize that. It's toxic here because it would result in us paying more taxes to fund Republican parts of the state that do not like taxes to improve their schools. So that is part of the reason for a political impasse on that. Many states equalize levy funding that way in the interest of fairness. And, you know, and I think there's a good argument to be made that that is a more fair system.
Much more to come on this. One final question for you, Joel Connolly. One Republican state representative tweeted that the state Supreme Court has gone rogue. It is time for articles of impeachment. That's obviously not a majority view, I don't think, even in the Republican Party. But how much of a political fight do you think we are in for now with the court trying to push the legislature in this?
There are easy partisan things to do. This is one of them. You can probably get a great big round of applause at a Lincoln Day dinner if you were to say something like this, the rogue court, the court that has gone too far. On the other hand, there are talking points and applause lines on the other side. Part of the situation is I think we have gotten into a rut, a kind of a pilot-like situation where each side blames the other. And also, your point was a very valid one about public opinion on this. Every single poll of the state shows that the voters think that public education is the number one priority, the number one issue. But at the same time, have they backed this with muscle? Have they ever backed this with an adamant insistence that the legislature actually get off its behind and do something about that? The answer, no.
Is the difference between saying polite things and actually acting, is anyone else thinking about Bernie Sanders right now, which we're going to talk about in just a moment? Okay, just to reset this week, the state Supreme Court fined the state $100,000 a day for every day we fail to fund education. Will the governor call another session in the summertime? Will Republicans try to impeach state Supreme Court judges? Stay tuned. And stay tuned to The Week in Review, Bernie Sanders and more in just a moment. Welcome back to KOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and all week long, Seattle has been talking about what happened Saturday at Westlake Park at a rally that included presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. It seemed to be going so well.
Thank you, Seattle, for being one of the most progressive cities in the United States of America.
Some demonstrators with the Black Lives Matter movement interrupted the rally's MC.
Going to let you on the mic. Okay. All right, so we are trying to be reasonable. We're going to let you on the mic. After Senator Sanders, you said.
After some back and forth, some people in the crowd started chanting, "Bernie, Bernie." The MC asked the crowd to let the demonstrators have their say.
Please let them speak. Go ahead.
I will speak when everyone is ready. I'll wait. Thank you for showing me how Black Lives Matter. Continue. This is the most liberal that we have. You guys are full of bullshit with your Black Lives Matter. Listen. My name. You're never going to hear Bernie speak unless I hear it silent here now.
It went on like that, and then...
Now that you've covered yourself in your white supremacist liberalism... I will formally welcome Bernie Sanders to Seattle. Bernie Sanders, I would like to welcome you to this place called Seattle, which is actually occupied Duwamish land, stolen, and hypocritically named after Chief Self. We are located in King County, where the silhouette of Martin Luther King reigns high while we spend $210 million building a new jail to imprison Black children. Welcome to Seattle, where our Seattle Police Department has been under federal consent decree for the past 3 years and yet has been riddled by use of force, racial profiling, and scandals throughout the year. I want to welcome you, Bernie, to Westlake, where we said Black Lives Matter on Black Friday. We shut down Westlake, and we shut down the tree lighting, and we have anointed this land saying, we will fight for Black lives no matter what it takes. Yeah! Welcome to Seattle, where the Seattle School Department suspends Black students at a rate 6 times higher than their counterparts. Bernie, welcome to Seattle, where we have undergone intense gentrification. In the Central District, where used to be the only place where we Black people could live legally in Seattle.
You've been listening to Marissa Johnson speaking there at that rally in Seattle at Westlake Park. According to a KOW producer I talked to who was there, I was not, after she spoke, she still did not just give up the microphone. I believe she said she wanted to ask Sanders something on stage. Sanders conferred with his staff. And eventually he walked away from the protest. He did not speak. On our panel, Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo, you have been writing and living Black Lives Matter issues since way before we had that name. What do you think happened on Saturday?
You know, what I think happened was we saw boiling over a lot of the anger and frustration that a lot of Black people in Seattle feel every day. When you live in a city that labels itself progressive and yet has a large amount of silence around the structural oppression in this city that affects Black people day in and day out, that anger you see, that hurt that you see, is something that Black people feel everywhere. And so for a lot of Black people, what they were listening to had less to do with Bernie Sanders and more to do with the reaction of the audience to those words and to that pain and the inability to listen there. So that's really what I've been focusing on as a writer and as a community member here in the city.
Joel Connolly, in your column at SeattlePI.com, you said, among other things, we have a liberal city to defend against radicals. What did you mean by that?
I mean that I'm upset at someone. I'm upset at the shouting down of people. I'm upset.
Which shouting down of people are we talking about?
People not being able to speak, and certain points of view being unwelcome in a supposedly inclusive city.
Are you talking about the demonstrators not allowing Bernie Sanders to speak?
I think this was an example of that. And to label what the crowd did as racist, well, let me give you an example. In June, we had a big rally at Town Hall for our Trotskyist socialist city council member, Shama Sawant. An hour and a half into the rally, there was a fundraising pitch. Everybody is hot and tired, and the pitch goes on and on. You would get $650, $600, $500, and there became an obvious upset in terms of let Sharma speak. Give this person the hook. We want Sharma. Obviously, the crowd there wanted to hear Sharma Sawant, just as the crowd on Saturday wanted to hear Bernie Sanders, who would have talked about, among other things, unemployment among African-American youth and our hideous incarceration rate in this country. So essentially, there was a desire of that crowd, just as there was a desire of Sharma's crowd, to hear the main attraction. I would not label that protest as being racist, since Sharma is, of course, an immigrant, and the labor bureaucrat that was occupying so much time was white.
Ijeoma, so you heard Joel say this was just about, hey, we're here to hear this person speak. Let the man talk.
What I'd say is that, you know, Bernie Sanders is running for public office to represent all of the people in the area. And it's not just about the agenda of the white people that were there to listen. Black people have an agenda and things that they want to be heard for, and they want to make sure that their candidates hear and are addressing, and they're going to take any opportunity they can get. This is more important than fundraising. This is more important than the next 4 years. People are dying. We have over 800 people killed by police so far this year. This is life and death. And so for black people to hear that, oh, they just wanted to hear Bernie speak, you know, there are plenty of black people who want to hear black people speak, and they want to hear black people address Bernie Sanders and really have their issues, which are life and death, take front and center.
I would suggest, however, that when then-Senator Barack Obama appeared at Garfield High School for Senator Cantwell about 8 or 9 years ago, there was a protest there that allegedly the people organizing Obama's event had not, quote, talked to the community. I think that in case of Senator Sanders, he's running for president, yes, but he has an agenda. He has a program directed at some of the fundamental issues of Black Lives Matter, namely incarceration, namely unemployment, and so on. I think for people of the country to make a decision on who's going to be their next president, you should hear that and then react to it. And I think the option that was offered, which was to hear Bernie and then react to him, was quite a reasonable one.
If I may, then why didn't Bernie Sanders speak? I mean, the crowd could have listened understandingly, with empathy, whether they agree or not, to what these people had to say, and then Bernie Sanders could have then spoken if he'd wanted to.
There was an insistence that, you know, again, that he be interrogated. Down in Phoenix at Netroots Nation, you had a situation where the protesters spoke, and then Sanders did take the floor and did speak directly to the issues of youth unemployment, directly to the issues of incarceration, directly to the issues of the number of young black men who are incarcerated for nonviolent offenses and this type of thing. He did take the floor in Phoenix, and that is what he spoke to.
Yeah, so he could have taken the stage and spoken. They didn't shut down Bernie Sanders.
He had a stage at the University of Washington with 13,000 people inside and outside, where he spoke precisely to these issues, and I would say far more directly than any other candidate for president.
Yeah, he had a stage. Erica C. Barnett is here with us too.
I just wanted to say that I think, first of all, Bernie Sanders is not going to be our next president. And I think that the fact that he is sort of the, you know, liberal, radical, whatever you want to call it, candidate, it makes his rally the perfect place to cede the microphone to folks from Black Lives Matter who wanted to speak. I think he could have made a real statement by staying on stage, by letting them speak, and by answering their questions. I think that would have spoken much more loudly than after the fact putting a thing about racial equality on his website, which was his reaction to this. I was not terribly impressed by that. And, you know, and I think that the reaction of the white liberals in the audience was basically, as my friend Roger Valdez described it in Publicola, kind of a sense of noblesse oblige and, you know, we gave it the office. Now get off stage. Let Bernie speak. And I was not at all impressed by their reaction.
Ijeoma, what would Seattle white liberals have to do to convince you that they're not guilty of complacency, that they're walking the walk?
In all honesty, I mean, these issues would have to be something that they're talking about on a regular basis. I want white people asking, why aren't we talking about Black Lives Matter more? Why aren't we all checking up on police reform and pushing it forward? Why aren't we looking at things like education reform, which does disproportionately affect children of color with our current levy system? Why aren't these issues front and center every day? And not just as a byproduct of class, because we like to say it's class, not race. But the truth is that they work together and separate, and race is a separate structure that we need to be looking at. And the truth is we have so many issues affecting people of color in Seattle that white people are so silent on, including things like the Somali remittance crisis, that we don't see our friends and neighbors that are supposed to be one with us talking about on a regular basis. And there needs to be just as much political pressure on every candidate to address issues that are affecting Black lives as there are issues that affect white lives.
You just identified a big issue that I think this is about in Seattle, which is Bernie Sanders has talked about racial injustice, but he's identified, and a lot of liberals are identified, with the cause of economic injustice. What is the difference between really being active and agitating and forcefully pushing on economic injustice versus racial injustice? Because we know the two are linked.
They are linked, but often what it is for the reason, part of the reason why Black people often fall into the lower classes is because of the racial hierarchy. And we have things like Black men are feared in the streets. You know, that very same Westlake Mall, we had a Black man maced by a security guard for simply being Black. And there was no repercussions. That guard is still working. These things contribute day in and day out. When you go and you apply for a job and you're four times less likely to be hired if you have a Black sounding name, there are no economic changes you can make that will address that issue. That is a race issue that has economic consequences. And we need to look at the structural race issues within our culture that then later have economic consequences. We often treat it like it's the economics that affect race, when it's race that affects the economics of Black people.
You, in your column, Joel, you pointed out the Seattle support for African-American candidates over the years. What's your evidence that Seattle has done enough to address issues of injustice?
Seattle has not done enough. You profoundly move me, since I know have African-American friends who are followed in stores. That is an absolutely valid point that hits an open nerve. With that said, however, I'd talk a little bit about the history of the town. I just, before coming here, walked around the corner to mail a letter at the post office box at 23rd and 34th and Union. Across from across the street there was the headquarters about 40, 45 years ago of the Black Panther Party. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and some people in Seattle Police wanted to shoot their way in, the same way with, say, the murder of Fred Hampton in Chicago. But we had a political leadership at the time that refused to do that and decided, in the famous words of Churchill, it was better to jaw jaw than war war. So you had political leaders taking the walk into Panther headquarters. Black lives mattered then. And to put against, you know, to put opposite what you have just said, there have been episodes such as that, such as the outrage in the community of the murder of Urban League's Ed Pratt, such as the Central Seattle Community Council Federation blowing the whistle on the bank's redlining of minority neighborhoods in this city, taking considerable financial penalty from the United Way for doing so, and things like this. So I do not think that we are contented, and I do not think that we are self-satisfied, but I do think that we could do more, and I have had to talk to people on the morning after they were followed in the drugstore.
Well, I have much more to say about this. We're talking about issues that we'll be talking about for perpetuity, maybe. Any last words on this topic before we move on?
Well, I wanted to just briefly touch on a meeting I was at the other night, there was a kind of similar crowd. It was about homeless people in Ballard. And the reaction from the crowd to the idea of homeless people in their neighborhood struck me as very similar. They were, you know, in this case, you know, in Black Lives Matter and in the case of Bernie Sanders, it was we are not racist. In the case of this homeless encampment, it was we are not classist. We like homeless people. You know, we just don't want them in our neighborhood. We like black people. We just don't want them at our rally. And I was just really struck by the similarity of the crowd, the makeup of the crowd. It was almost all white. And liberal, you know, Ballard homeowners, but the sentiment was very much the same.
Are we finally starting to have that national conversation about race that we've been asked to have for decades? Does something feel different these days?
It does to me, definitely. I feel like young people in America, especially since Ferguson, have really figured out that we can't wait. And when we look at these escalating numbers of police violence, when we look at the 12 times differential in personal wealth between black and white people in America, we've realized that being nice, asking please, and waiting isn't working. And we're forcing a conversation that people have told us we could only get there if we were just nice enough and patient enough. But here we are, 60 years later, still pretty much in the same situation that we were.
As we said, Bernie Sanders did speak later that Saturday at the University of Washington, and you can hear his speech at KUOW.org. This is the Week in Review. We're going to talk about race might come up again when we talk about flavored tobacco in hookah lounges and more coming up on the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm joined by Seattle writer Ijeoma Oluo, Erica C. Barnett from The C is for Crank, Joel Connolly, SeattlePI.com. Seattle's mayor wants to shut down the city's hookah lounges. These are places where people, many of them from North and East Africa and the Middle East, smoke flavored tobacco from hookah pipes. We have these clubs in the International District, downtown, and in North Seattle as well. Some Seattleites are protesting the mayor's plan to shut those places down. Some patrons and owners and civil rights leaders say that hookah lounges are being unfairly linked to gun violence. Seattle Mayor Ed Murray told KUOW this week that this is not just coming from him. He's being urged to shut these places down by people in these immigrant communities.
There's also folks, again, leaders in the East African community, particularly people in the Somali community who are involved in the Somali Health Board, who believe that we are allowing something to happen to their young people that we are not allowing to happen to other young people. In other words, being exposed to a carcinogenic that leads to incredibly bad health outcomes. So there are different ways to look at this. Now, there is methodology, and we could go to the state if there is some sort of private not-for-profit club where this activity would go on, and that's something we can explore. But that's very different than a for-profit organization that is engaging in an activity, smoking, that is illegal under state law, and many of them not paying their taxes, and numerous, and I'm not just talking about dozens, in some cases hundreds, of complaints, and add on to that young East African men being shot dead, and in the case of Chinatown, one of our great Chinese American leaders in Seattle shot dead. So I don't think you can kind of make an argument that this is about trying to do something about somebody's culture.
You just heard Seattle's mayor give several reasons for wanting to shut down hookah lounges. Erica C. Barnett, some people don't buy all his reasons. Why do you think he's really doing this?
I think it's something that comes up every, you know, decade or so, which is that there is violence or there are other problems adjacent to and sometimes associated with a certain type of business that youth in particular like to patronize. The city freaks out and they announce a crackdown. In the 90s, it was hip hop clubs. It's been bars in Belltown. There was talk about staggering closing times because everybody spills out at 2 in the morning. And this time it's hookah lounges. And I think the fact that Ed Murray had some members of the East African community in support of him does not speak to the culture of hookah lounges entirely, because the young people who patronize these businesses, you know, say tell a different story and say it is part of their culture. And I think that At the very least, Mayor Murray is guilty of cultural insensitivity in not not adequately linking these hookah lounges to any crime, for one thing, and for not thinking about the fact that this is a very particular section of Seattle's population. It is a minority segment of Seattle's population, and it's immigrants. And he didn't consider that, and now I think he's doubling down on the defensive.
So you're saying maybe the mayor didn't connect enough with these immigrant communities. He's an experienced politician. Why do you think, well, let me put this to Joel Connolly, why do you think the mayor's proposing this, shutting down these hookah lounges now, before the Seattle police have even made a more clear connection between hookah lounges and shootings?
I'd make a couple of points. First of all, I thought he probably thought that this was a popular policy. If you go to City Hall, all announcements by Mayor Murray are basically political shows of force. People who support what he's doing behind him, his department heads and so on along the wall. I thought he thought it was probably a popular thing to do. The second thing is something that transcends all considerations of race and ethnicity and age and so on. This was simply a policy that needed a lot longer in the oven. It came out half-baked with various assumptions, which we've just heard the mayor make, that are not necessarily true and have not necessarily been checked out. He rushed to it too quickly without quietly talking to the police about whether the assumptions of the policy were true.
That's pretty critical. Half-baked and just doing something he thought was popular over whether it's the right thing. Ijeomaluo, any other take?
Yeah, I honestly think it's quite egregious that he would link these establishments to violence when we don't even have the reports out from the police, especially when we're dealing with a segment of the population that is routinely blamed for violence in our cities. And the truth is that Seattleites in general are often afraid of groups of East Africans that they encounter together, especially late at night. And this just plays into that. And I think it's very irresponsible when he doesn't even have the data to provide on that. And so I do really worry about the message this sends out to Seattle in general, even greater than these businesses as it is. I worry about the message this sends out to the Somali Americans in our community.
But aren't these businesses illegal anyway because there's an indoor smoking ban?
Well, you're allowed to have a private club. And I thought it was interesting. I've never heard this idea of a nonprofit smoking lounge that Mayor Murray floated among his many, many reasons for wanting to shut these down. You can have a private club. And in fact, there are some private clubs that are patronized primarily by white people that are not being targeted, that where smoking is allowed.
Well, he said that the city has cracked down on cigar lounges. Are you talking about that?
I'm not talking about cigar lounges. I'm talking about other places that are private clubs where you do have to be a member, and and it's maybe a little more formal than paying $5 at the door, which is what you do at a hookah lounge, but where you can smoke a cigarette.
Are they smoking lounges? They're advertising this is what we do?
The one that I know of is not a smoking lounge, no. Smoking is just allowed.
Oh, well, we do a lot of things that aren't allowed.
I'd like to make one other quick point, this one about ethnicity. I think the mayor is a stubborn Irishman. But he is also somebody who believes deeply in social justice, was schooled in this at the University of Portland, has practiced it as a representative, a member of a sexual minority in the legislature, moving for civil rights step by step by step. I would hope that the social justice aspect prevails over the stubborn Irish suspect, and he rethinks this.
Okay, so in support there, it sounds like you're saying that you think the mayor's been more ignorant than cynical in this case.
He's a stubborn Irishman. He's an Irish politician who likes to do things, but he's also again deeply committed on the social justice point. And I think it's time again to take a step back. Or more than that, take several steps across the street to Kathy O'Toole's office, get the people together, and see whether those assumptions that you just ran are true.
Kathleen O'Toole being our police chief. Okay, Seattle's mayor wanting to shut down the hookah lounges, saying he's open to changing his mind if he thinks he misjudged the community. City Council member Nick Licata has asked him to reconsider the ban, saying it would punish a whole class of people. We'll keep following that issue here on The Week in Review on KUOW. Welcome back to The Week in Review, debating, discussing, learning from the big news of this week. We just heard about the chance of showers. I don't think we've solved our drought with a little bit of a rain dropping the last two out of the last 3 days. We've had record heat. We've had a long, dry summer. And Seattle and Tacoma and Everett are asking you to cut back on your water use by 10%. They're asking. It's voluntary. It's up to you. How should you do it? We have Kelly O'Rourke, Water Conservation Planner at Seattle Public Utilities. Welcome back to KUOW.
Hello.
Kelly, who are the biggest water users? What are the biggest drains on the reservoir?
Well, most of our water goes to our collective single-family customers. So a large portion of the water is going to single-family customers.
Really? So not farming, not industry, not the parks, single-family homes?
In collective, yes.
Yeah.
If you take them all together, absolutely.
Hmm.
And then businesses are obviously the rest of it for the most part. And there's really not much agricultural that happens in our area.
Okay, so mostly the collective single-family homeowners. And of those people, what is the biggest drain on the reservoir from what you do in your home?
It is irrigation. So this time of year in the summer, water use is twice as much as it is in the winter, and that's primarily outdoor water use and primarily irrigation.
Irrigation meaning watering your lawn, your plants.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's why our top two tips are to asking folks to let their lawns go dormant and then also to limit plant watering to twice a week. So basically everything else to twice a week.
What about in the winter?
Well, in the winter, then really the focus is on indoor, and you can still focus on indoor efficiency right now. The two biggest water users in the residential setting are toilets and clothes washers. And so for any water use, you can think about the equipment and its efficiency and then your use of it. So for indoor, you can look at your fixtures and say, do I have efficient toilets and clothes washers and shower heads, etc.? Or just think about how you're using them. So one of our tips is with showering, just take a shorter shower. You know, try and step out of the shower a minute or two earlier.
Are you asking us to voluntarily not flush the toilet as much?
Not yet. You know, we'd actually like to hold that one out in case we had to go to our next step, which we're hoping not to have to go to, but that's our mandatory stage. So at this point, you could just think about, you know, try and maybe not use your toilet like a trash can. So if you are just, you know, trying to toss out a Kleenex, put it in your trash can, not in your toilet. But we're not asking folks to let it, if it's yellow, let it mellow or anything like that.
Right.
Hopefully we won't have to go there.
Well, you just took me back to I will never forget, my straight-laced parents moved to Vashon Island, and I came home to visit them during college. And I said, Mom, Dad, is the toilet malfunctioning? And my mom, that was the first I'd ever heard, son, kid, hey, man. If it's yellow, let it mellow. Are you my parents? I went around and checked the house number, make sure I was in the right place. But so you named toilets as being a big deal. Why aren't you including that on our list of voluntary conservation tricks?
Well, at this point, we're really trying to focus more on people's behavior. We're not really wanting to ask folks to go out and have to, you know, spend money and upgrade toilets. If folks,
I'm just talking about mellow yellow.
Well, for that one, we feel like that's a big ask for a lot of folks. So our plan for shorting
the yuck factor.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay. What about where are renters in all of this? If you don't have a single family home, you don't have a lawn. And by the way, you probably don't have an incentive to save water because your utilities are included in your rent. Where are you in all of this?
Yeah, there's still a lot of great things folks can do. So it's thinking about your use of your indoor fixtures. So again, back to showers, take shorter showers. Clothes washers and dishwashers, just make sure that you're washing full loads. Toilets, again, just don't use it as a trash can. If you see leaks, tell your landlord, have your landlord fix it. If you have a car, take it to a facility that recycles the wash water. So definitely still great things renters can do to conserve water and reduce their use by 10%.
Kelly O'Rourke with Seattle Public Utilities, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Hear that? You too, Erica C. Barnett, have a role to play.
I would say my landlord also has a role I try very hard to conserve water, even though I pay many, many times more than I actually use in the automatic fee that, quote unquote, comes along with my rent. But I mean, I think that with washers and dryers and things like that, that's not something renters have a whole lot of control over. So it's kind of up to landlords to put energy efficient washers and dryers in the units. I do think I just want to get in, note the fact that the lawn problem is yet another argument against single family home ownership and the pattern of single family dwellings in Seattle. Very wasteful, and it's an argument for density.
We normally have plenty of water around here, don't we?
Well, sure. But, well, I don't know. This may be the new normal.
Yeah, it may be the new normal.
This is not the first dry summer.
Any other last words on water? Joel Connolly.
I have a problem. We're on a well system at Weekend Place on Whitby, which is also has a woodland garden, which also has hellebores, plants that when they are unhappy and in a drought situation go flat and basically display their misery. So even while I try to conserve water and I try to be sensitive to the well, I'm being guilt-tripped by a plant.
Ijeoma Oluo, you're saving?
You know, I think that I honestly wish they would just kind of jump ahead and go ahead and make it mandatory. I can't even budget like 2 months down the road for money, let alone something as obscure as water. And we're going to find ourselves in this situation more and more often. And we always wait until we're in dire straits before we get there. And I don't want to have a California situation.
Also, just tell us what to do.
Just tell us, say, hey, do this. And I will do those things. Otherwise, tell me, hey, would you mind trying to reduce by 10%? I don't even know what that means.
Right.
Well, they have a California situation. The predictions are that our climate is going the direction of San Jose.
Right, right. Well, you know, this brings me right to our next topic, because speaking of being forced to do the right thing, the city of Seattle is now going to enforce the rule that we all sort of know we should obey, the rule against blocking the box. You know what I'm talking about? This is when you try to get across a busy intersection, but the traffic ahead of you doesn't end up budging like you prayed it would, and your light turns red, and now you're stuck in the middle of the intersection, blocking the cross traffic and the pedestrians who now have a green light, but they can't go because of you. So the city has been, you know, I've never seen anybody get a ticket, but it looks like the city is going to start enforcing. Good idea or bad idea?
Good idea.
I think it's a great idea, too. Sorry, Joel.
I just watched Washington, D.C. do it when I was our correspondent back there. And they targeted class. It was a class system in reverse. The cops stayed on major intersections and ticketed Mercedes, you know, the lobbyist cars coming in from the Virginia and the Maryland suburbs. It was a very high-profile program. It worked quickly.
And I think, you know, when you were describing that and you said I'm not really typically a driver. And so I was thinking from the pedestrian perspective, it is horrible when people do that. Yes, it's generally technically safe to walk out into traffic when traffic is not moving. But that is what I have to do all the time. I work downtown. I have been in South. I, you know, go to South Lake Union quite a bit. It is so irritating and it is dangerous. And I'm thrilled that they are doing it. And I hope it's with red light cameras so that officers are not forced to walk out into traffic themselves and issue individual tickets at people's windows. But if that's what it takes, that's what it takes.
Ijeoma, what do you think? Write those tickets?
No, honestly, I don't think it's a great idea. I mean, warnings, I think, might be good. But the truth is we've all found ourselves in that situation. I always feel worse for the poor driver who misjudged and they're embarrassed and they're like, please, 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 please.
It is the longest 60 seconds of your life.
It really is. And I don't think it is something, it's not necessarily a public safety issue. It's really more of an inconvenience issue. And when we look at things like police fines, you know, you were talking about, you know, how people could target Mercedes. If we could do it that way, fine, whatever, if you have the money to afford it. But when we look at the toll that traffic fines take on lower classes, especially, when you can't afford to pay that ticket, your license gets suspended. And if you get caught driving with a suspended license, you can go to jail. That affects your ability to feed your family. So I think we really do need to prioritize what we're going to issue these tickets for.
Really quick point. I think that one other reason besides public safety is that this makes traffic much worse because people can't go. And I mean, a study found that, you know, a recent study that this is sort of the result of found that, you know, that a huge amount of the traffic, particularly like around the Mercer Mess, is because people are sitting in, you know, out in the road and the oncoming traffic can't get through. So you have a mess.
So you wouldn't mind being inconvenienced when you're sitting at a Bernie Sanders rally. But if somebody tries to make it in the intersection and slows you down, how dare you?
I'm looking at the system. I'm not looking at me. And I'm saying the system will work better if people follow the rules.
Well, there's that. We've been running down the top stories of the week on KOW's Week in Review with Joel Connolly from the SeattlePI.com, Erica C. Barnett with the C is for Crank, Ijeoma Olua, a writer, speaker, internet yeller. As you've said, your work's in The Guardian and Time and New York Magazine, The Stranger, and a whole bunch. You also have had this very popular essay on our website, KOW.org, where you give the parenting advice, don't kill them.
Yes.
Please explain. We have about a minute.
Honestly, it's just for all those parents out there who feel forced into the competitive parenting that is so popular, especially in liberal circles. The truth is there will be some days where if they end the day in the same condition that they started, you are a parenting genius because kids can be tough.
Yeah. And you lay it out colorfully in your essay. And you think that, if I get you right, that the idea that parenting is supposed to be a gift, a blissful gift, is a conspiracy to get us to stop complaining about how hard it really is.
Yes, and it stops us from examining gender roles, parenting roles, distribution of that. It stops us from examining a lot of things in our society that we just take for granted. And the truth is, kids are tough. It's a lot of work. And if we acknowledge that, we'd have to acknowledge the work that our caregivers are giving.
Please join us at Facebook, our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. We are on Twitter at KUOW. We would love to hear from you. Thank you, all of you, for analyzing and learning from the news of the week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Join us again next week. Our producer is Jason Pagano. We talked with Kelly O'Rourke from Seattle Public Utilities, Rachel LaCourte with Associated Press. You didn't miss a thing if you go to our website, KUOW.org, and get our podcast. See you next week.